This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 249 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. The topic of conversation this week on Fantasy Twitter was most definitely Todd Gurley and what the hell we should be doing with him in our fantasy drafts. And Daryl Henderson, too. So I wasn't surprised when I got this question from @FFTylerO that said, "How are you handling the Rams' backfield? If we were going to see this Gurley slip, wouldn't it make sense to go with Henderson? But then again, Malcolm Brown exists. Seems like a mess, but are we really going to avoid this juicy backfield?" I've talked about the Gurley thing a lot on this show since the draft happened, because like I've said, that's the first time we see teams making forced decisions after the season ends. They can choose to be passive during free agency if they want, but they can't really be passive during the NFL draft. And what did the Rams do? They spent a pretty high pick on a running back when they've got Todd Gurley already in their backfield, and they traded up to do so. But not only that, we can't forget that they also matched a Malcolm Brown offer that the Lions gave him because he was a restricted free agent. So back in March, reading between the lines, the Rams seemed to want that security behind Todd Gurley. And then they went out and traded up to get Daryl Henderson. On the Late Round Podcast episode immediately following the draft, I said that, quote, "If you've got Todd Gurley and this doesn't scare the living hell out of you, then I don't know what to say." And yes, I just quoted myself. Nothing's actually changed with Todd Gurley since then. All that's changed is the conversation around the injury. We're getting more sound bites, and that's lowering Gurley's ADP more, and it's making Daryl Henderson a very set-in-stone mid-round pick. I tend to shy away from players who are very obviously injured heading into a season, let alone a player who's being drafted in the early rounds. So at his current ADP, which over the last week has been RB10 on draft, I'm not likely to draft Todd Gurley. And you may be sitting there saying, "But JJ, Todd Gurley has RB1 upside, as in the RB1 in fantasy football." Does he though? Just because he's done that in the past doesn't mean that that's in his reasonable range of outcomes here in 2019. What got this conversation going this week was Ian Rappaport reporting that Gurley would no longer be a bell cow back. And what evidence do we have to say that this isn't true? He splits a backfield in the playoffs. The team matches an offer sheet on Malcolm Brown. The Rams draft Daryl Henderson in the third round after trading up. We have plenty of reason to believe that this report is true. And if that's the case, if we assume Todd Gurley's bell cow days are over, then Gurley's upside clearly isn't some high-end RB1. So if you're drafting him as a low-end RB1, are you really getting that much value out of the pick? Well, I asked Twitter this very question, and I got a lot of different answers. The people who were pro Todd Gurley came back with the fact that he'd still have a high floor next season since the situation is good, and that even if you take something like 70% of his production from last year, he's still an RB1. Now, I've got a few problems with that reasoning. First, even though he'll have a chance to score touchdowns at a higher rate than anyone else in the league given his situation, he did score 21 times in 14 games last year. He ended up scoring on every 15 touches. We've had 54 seasons over the last 8 years where a running back has touched the ball 300 plus times in a season, and Gurley's touches per touchdown rate from 2018, that's the lowest. Now, his 2017 rate was fifth lowest, so clearly this is a good situation to be in. But his 2017 rate also saw him score every 18.1 touches. So when you divvy up what he did in 2018, you're divvying up a season that was more than likely unsustainable. It wasn't unsustainable like you'd see from another back who scored on every 15 touches, but it was unsustainable to some degree. Now, the other thing to note is that we don't exactly know how Todd Gurley is going to be used. The allure with Todd Gurley over the last 2 years has definitely been his opportunity, but it's also been his opportunity in the red zone and close to the goal line. In 2017 and 2018 combined, and this is only the regular season, Todd Gurley has 126 red zone carries. The player in second is Ezekiel Elliott, who has 79. Gurley has scored 29 red zone touchdowns over this time, which is 10 more than the second place Alvin Kamara. And Gurley also has 44 goal line carries, when Mark Ingram, who's in second, has 30. I mean, Gurley's opportunity over the last two seasons has been something fantasy managers dream of. But are we to assume that this is where the Rams want to deploy Todd Gurley, where they know he's going to get banged up against goal line fronts? Because some small sample evidence doesn't really suggest this. In their playoff games last year, Todd Gurley didn't see a single goal line touch. CJ Anderson had 4. In the red zone, Todd Gurley only had 2 carries. CJ Anderson had 15. All the while, in the playoffs last year, Gurley was outrushed by Anderson 46-30. But when you ratio that thing out, Anderson was clearly the one benefiting from red zone trips, not Todd Gurley. This really just brings me to a point that I think is really important. Historic data goes into building a projection. Of course it does. But building your case for a player strictly off of how he's performed in the past isn't going to be as accurate as what a projection is going to tell you, as long as that projection is under a good process. Like, we can take 70% of Todd Gurley's 2018 production and say, even with this production, he'd be a low-end RB1. But that's also a low-end RB1 within the context of the 2018 landscape. And that was a landscape that was weaker at running back, not only because there were fewer workhorse types than we're projecting for in 2019, but because there are things like injuries or players not taking over their backfield until mid-season. And not only that, taking 70% of Todd Gurley's 2018 production and saying he'd still be an RB1 is sort of my point, you guys. If we know he's not going to be a bell cow, if we assume that's the case, then 70% or 80% of what he did over the last 2 years might be his ceiling. And if that's his ceiling, then you're drafting Todd Gurley at his ceiling right now in drafts. Like, at some point, Todd Gurley will become a value. But I still can't get behind Todd Gurley if I'm taking him over players who have that bell cow potential. And that trickles through the mid-second round. And then you're also then drafting Gurley ahead of some studs at wide receiver, which is a tough thing to do. And that's why it's hard for me to get behind Todd Gurley. Right now, because this is obviously subject to change with more information, but it's hard for me to get behind Todd Gurley in the first two rounds of drafts. That means, quite obviously, that your mind should shift to Daryl Henderson. But his ADP is rising just as Todd Gurley's is falling. Here's the thing, though. There's a significant difference in opportunity cost when you're talking about an early second-round pick versus a 6th, 7th, or 8th round pick. Like, Daryl Henderson won't project to be a high-end RB3. His projection won't be that high. But Henderson's ceiling is arguably stronger than any other running back that you'd get in his ADP range. I don't think we should expect Henderson to have bell cow potential if Todd Gurley's injury is a bigger deal than we currently think. But he's going to likely be a double-digit touch-per-game player if Todd Gurley is banged up. And in that Rams offense, as I've been talking about throughout this entire intro, that's enough to be a weekly starter. It's just not enough to be drafted in the early second round. Look, guys, I don't have some sort of agenda here. I'm trying to brain vomit so that you know where I stand and how I'm thinking about Todd Gurley. It's early June right now. There are plenty of things that can and will change. But my stance on Gurley can be boiled down to this. Even with a reduced workload, Todd Gurley can be projected to be a low-end RB1. And that's where he's being drafted right now. But that's not how I spend my early round picks. My goal isn't to draft an RB10 when his ceiling isn't likely to be much higher than that. At least his perceived ceiling with the information that we have at the time of making that pick. I want a player who can give me that baseline floor while also providing the real potential to jump into the elite tier of running backs. Maybe you think Todd Gurley has that ceiling, and that's totally fine. You're more optimistic about his workload than I am. But if we assume his bell cow days are truly over, it's going to be very, very hard for him to finish any higher than his current average draft position. Now, we've got more questions for this week's mailbag, but before getting to them, I want to let you guys know about FanDuel's new three-man MLB challenge. You know, some nights you just don't have time to put in all the research to compete in daily fantasy baseball. You just want to crank out a lineup and enjoy the game. Well, with the three-man MLB challenge, you just pick three hitters for the night, and the only stats that count are hits, homers, and runs batted in. To give it a shot, check out the FanDuel lobby today. This first question is an email. It says, "Hey JJ, I noticed you drafted OJ Howard in the 5th round in your recent MFL 10 of Death League. This seems like you're going against your own advice when you recently said that Kelce is probably the only tight end worth drafting in the early rounds. Otherwise, you may as well wait on one. Do you approach the tight end position differently in best ball? Thanks, Alex." So there are definitely a few layers to this one. If you listened to my tight end strategy podcast last summer, which is pretty evergreen in nature, then you might remember me saying that you basically either go big or go home at tight end. You either get an early round tight end, or you just wait on someone. Because we almost always see a George Kittle type player emerge each year. Maybe not to that degree, but we see late round tight ends emerge. And we generally have decent enough hit rates with early round tight ends. The middle round guys are the ones that you typically want to avoid. Technically, I'd consider what I did with OJ Howard a middle round move, which means I'm going against my own advice. So I think that makes this a good moment to talk through my process, so I appreciate this question. First off, with this draft in particular, I knew the other managers in this league tend to value tight ends higher than normal. The position does become a little more important in best ball because they're slightly more versatile than quarterbacks because they can be flexed, and you don't have to predict when that flexing would occur. I'll be doing a tight end podcast later this summer, so teaser alert, but I see the tight end position as follows. And this is a reiteration of what I said on last week's mailbag show a bit. But I think Ertz and Kittle are overvalued at their ADP. Ertz, you've got serious volume concerns, at least compared to last year. And Kittle, you've got some regression concerns given how insane his yards per target rate was last year. Though I do think that Kittle makes a lot more sense than Ertz. I think Kittle has a much better chance to return his investment and be really good. With tight ends, you're always looking for guys who can take a jump into that elite tier and give you a week-to-week edge. And unlike previous seasons with mid-round tight ends, or tight ends in rounds 5 through like 8 or so, I just see OJ Howard and Hunter Henry as a little different. Maybe even Evan Ingram there. I think there's plenty of upside there, especially with Howard, the guy that I drafted. Howard is going to be, at worst, the number 3 option in the Buccaneers offense, which is one that's going to throw the ball down the field and likely throw the ball often. And since it's a best ball draft, you're looking for upside. As Nelly once said, 2 is not a winner and 3 nobody remembers. Howard not only has the upside to potentially reach that Kittle and Ertz tier, but that becomes even greater with a potential injury to Chris Godwin or Mike Evans. So I'm just shooting for ceiling here. In a regular season-long draft, I probably wouldn't have pulled the trigger. But the best ball format is different. I do love me some OJ Howard this year, though. My projections actually have him as the tight end 4 in a tier of his own before hitting Evan Ingram and Hunter Henry. This next question is from @J_Michael51. Many think Curtis Samuel is a better player than DJ Moore, based largely on film, but Moore had 788 yards as a rookie compared to Samuel's career 609 yards over 22 games. How do we balance what has happened versus what we think should happen? Yeah, this is one of those situations where I don't mind either player at their ADP despite them playing for the same team. You would think that I'd strongly favor one, but I really don't. DJ Moore's big issue down the stretch last year was that he couldn't find the end zone. He had just 2 touchdowns all year, and he didn't score after his huge performance against Detroit, where he went off for 7 catches for 157 yards and a touchdown in mid-November. Moore also didn't play 50% of Carolina's snaps consistently until a Week 8 game against Baltimore. From that point through Week 15, which was Cam Newton's last game of the season, Moore saw 18.4% of Carolina's pass attempts go his way. During that same stretch, Curtis Samuel was at about 16%. So as a rookie, Moore was seeing more volume when he was on the field. And he gave us that ceiling game against Detroit so that we all could see what he's capable of doing. I'm not of the belief that DJ Moore is simply some yak player who's going to be limited as a player in where he lines up offensively. And that brings me to my next point, which is that he was an incredible prospect. DJ Moore is one of the most productive wide receivers that you can find from a prospecting standpoint. And that came with a strong breakout age. Curtis Samuel was fine, but he wasn't DJ Moore as a prospect. Maybe the gap between the two shouldn't be as large in redraft as it is. But again, once you get into that range where you're taking DJ Moore, you're telling yourself a story of upside and potential. And that story is more easily told about DJ Moore than Curtis Samuel, which is why there's the discrepancy that we see in ADP. This next question is from @John042119. Later in rookie drafts, how much does the player, mainly a running back, being the perceived handcuff, affect your decision making? Would you still take a flyer wide receiver or pass-catching running back over a guy like Madison, Singletary, Armstead, etc.? Or is it all situation-dependent like most things? Yeah, I mean, it's probably situation-dependent, but I think that you've got to open your mind a bit to the fact that those guys might not be handcuffs, or at least won't be handcuffs longer term. I didn't like Singletary at all coming out, but I can still recognize that his 2020 opportunity, maybe even his 2019 opportunity, is going to be there based on the depth chart around him. It's him and some grandpas at running back right now in Buffalo. So my answer to this is that it's important to not label a lot of these running backs as handcuffs unless it's very obvious that they're handcuffs to a stud. Honestly, I sort of made that mistake with Benny Snell when the draft concluded. And while I do think that he leans more handcuffed than not, I should be a little more open to him grabbing hold of a larger role in that backfield in the next year or two than I initially thought. Just be open-minded about perceived handcuffs not being handcuffs once things get going, once their careers get going. Especially if they have draft capital associated with them, like someone like Damian Harris. Speaking of Damian Harris, this next one is from @remlap13. And it says, as a Sony Michel owner in Dynasty, should I be worried about Damian Harris stealing early down or goal line touches? That whole situation feels like a running back by committee waiting to happen, despite Sony lighting up the playoffs last season. So I've talked about Michel on this podcast plenty this offseason. I think that even if there isn't a committee there, Michel's limited by his pass-catching ceiling. The more backs in that backfield doesn't help his cause, obviously. So I'm fine with selling Michel if you want to, but it's not just because of the potential committee. It's because the amount of targets he may see in the passing game moving forward. This next question is from at King Harles. How valuable do you think the RB1, wide receiver 1, RB2, etc. nomenclatures are in fantasy football, and are there other ways of grouping players? I think it's valuable enough when you're casually talking about this stuff, but when you're talking about these groupings, you've also got to assume that the audience understands the context. Like, if I say high-end RB2, I hope people understand that there's a significant difference between a high-end RB1 and a high-end RB2, despite them only being one number apart. The bigger problem I have is when we talk in terms of season-long numbers, especially for running backs. When we say a player was an RB2 last year, a lot of times that just means that he was able to play a lot of games, that he didn't get hurt. We're better off looking at points per game. So I think that's when the terminology gets a little bit screwy. But if you're just casually talking about this stuff, I don't think it's that big of a deal to reference RB1 or RB2 or RB3. People then immediately know what you're talking about, at least the true degens. This next question is from at Eric Belair. When making season-long projections, how much weight do you give to head coaching / offensive coordinator play calling tendencies when projecting total rushes and passes for a team? I don't know how I'd quantify how much here, but I can tell you that coaching style definitely plays a role in my projections. But at the same time, you always have to remember that it's not just about what the team wants to do, but sometimes it's about what the team is forced to do. That's why I'm also looking at Vegas win totals and scheduling tools. If a team is expected to be good, then their pass to rush attempt ratio may drop a little based on that. If they're going to be bad, even if they want to be run heavy, they may not be able to be as run heavy as they'd like because they're playing from behind. You also run into some biases when you put too much stock into how an offensive coordinator or coach play calls, because you may not dig in and realize why they called plays the way that they did historically. Maybe it was because of what I just talked about with how many games their team won, but maybe it was just because of personnel. Personnel can and should absolutely dictate how a coach calls an offense. This is why you can't just assume that Green Bay is going to be this run-heavy team this year. Matt LaFleur ran a run-first offense in Tennessee last season, but he didn't have Aaron Rodgers. So just assuming that is bad process. We usually get information on this kind of stuff throughout an offseason, though. Like, you can confidently say that at least when games are in neutral scripts or when games are close, the Lions are likely going to be more run-heavy with Daryl Bevel. Not just because of his history, but because of the things that they're saying in the media. So it's a giant puzzle with a lot of moving parts. I use historic information on play callers, but I also try to give a lot of that information as much context as possible. This last question is from at @Jake_Chesser. What is the one or three things that someone who has been away from football since the end of the last fantasy season should know as they tip their toes back in? Now, you can go player by player, like with Todd Gurley, and give takes on each of those guys, because if someone hasn't followed football since the end of the season, they may not know news on individual players. So I would at least get to know depth charts and news on individual guys. But they probably should know that drafts have been going on for a while now as well. We have ADP because there's a large group of individuals who are sick in the head and they draft teams in March. So I'd analyze that ADP to get a good feel for the market. And then when you start to do your own research, you can immediately relate guys you're researching to where they're being drafted, and that's going to allow you to at least mentally come up with players to target and avoid based on the market value. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, please do me a favor and leave a rating and review. I'm also on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. You can follow me on there for some fantasy talk and bad dad jokes. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.